The following message was recorded at an event hosted by Desiring God. More information about Desiring God events, conferences, and resources is available at www.desiringgod.org.
I want to welcome you to the panel discussion. It's the final thrust that we have at the conference, but it's a very important time because God has been feeding us very profoundly through the unique instruments of each of these men. And I hope that questions have been percolating your mind, and we just want this time now to be a totally free-for-all of asking any questions to any of these men. And they have the right to decline, of course. But I just urge you to ask them, and if you could, step to the microphone. And then we won't need to repeat the questions. So let me pray and ask the Lord to use this time as well. Father, we thank you that you do not reject people who ask questions from a heart of hunger and humility. And that asking questions is the key to understanding. And Lord, I pray that this time of our panel discussion would be a time of opening more windows in our mind and in our heart, windows into truth and windows into your purpose, windows into ministry, windows into missions. And so, Lord, I pray that you would just guide each of these questions and guide these men as they respond. And Father, may you be glorified and may we be strengthened through this time together. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, I'm glad to see there's already people standing up. I think we'll start right here in the middle and direct your question to whoever you would like, and then we'll have answers.
I think I'll ask Pastor Piper to respond. Appreciate all of the lectures. I'm thankful. Dr. Wells, when he was speaking about the problem of our therapeutic approach in modern age, seem to very clearly articulate that we have a problem with the focus on the self, and the freedom is to get ourselves off of ourselves in that preoccupation and turn away. Yet at the same time, in your look at Augustine and your writings, you take and you mentioned a tension that exists in the Christian life between us pursuing in a, I don't want to use the word selfish way, but a self-gratifying way, God. And I wondered if you might, for the sake of bringing the two together, because I know you appreciate Dr. Wells and what he's saying, for our sake, bring what he's said and what you're saying together for us, how we seek God in the self, yet seek not to be self-centered. Is that understandable?
Yeah, it's understandable. And in your last little phrase was the answer. To seek God and to be self-centered are opposites. Now, I do put a spin on it that is vulnerable to misunderstanding, and it's a risk I take in order to waken people out of the absolute deadness of their bondage to lesser joys than God. And the spin I put on it is, I say, seek joy in God. A good reformed person would just say, seek God. And I think that's a necessary spin, because seek God just doesn't cut it. Doesn't mean anything. Where is he? What is it? What does that mean? So it's an effort to... Last night at supper, David, you said, or was it the night before, whenever we ate supper together, you said the key to common ground is not culture but creation. Boy, did that ring true to me. And that means don't look for trends, jump on them, and then try to steer the trend back to Jesus, but rather look for the deeper God-created realities. The key sentence I left out of Augustine, never mention it because everybody knows it, is we were made for God and we are restless until we find our rest in Him. So the created whole in the human being is a God-shaped whole. The world doesn't know it's God-shaped. They think it's TV-shaped and money-shaped and sex-shaped and power-shaped. And they're laboring to get these shapes into this hole. They don't fit. They're mauling themselves in the process. So I'm on a crusade to crawl into that hole with my message and just hack away at the misshapen conceptions that people have used to define this hole that's made for God. And I believe that if people will hear me out, it is a radical attack on self-centered life and on the health, wealth, and prosperity gospel. Not everybody will hear me out, and therefore they write crazy things about what I say. But he wouldn't be here if I didn't like what he said.
I wouldn't be here if I didn't like what you said, John.
Go ahead.
Dr. Piper, I wonder if you could address a couple things regarding doing these biographical sermons in our churches. What do you do differently in your presentation when you do present them to the church here, which I think you've said you do on occasion? And then also just address the process. When do you start reading? How do you choose what to read out of someone who's written a lot? And how do you deal with the tension of wanting to be a learner, and yet at the same time, it seems like at least in some years you've kind of chosen the topic and the man for the conference before you even get to the study, which I kind of did last year in my church, and that caused me some bumps.
I didn't understand that last part. Wanting to be a learner and choosing a man before you.
What? Well, for example, the year that Dr. Gruden was here, I assumed that you chose to do Lloyd-Jones because it fit the topic of the conference,
right, okay,
before you delved into Lloyd-Jones.
Right. Well, I go to the part I do understand. I don't take an hour and 15 minutes when I talk to the church. That's one difference. I've only done
one.
I did William Cooper in the church because we don't have an evening service anymore on Sunday. We do it on Wednesday. So I would do it just the same way I did it with you guys, only try to maybe do it in 2 weeks instead of 1 week. As far as the process goes, I asked my assistant, Rick, and anybody else, what are the best biographies? I can't read but one or two. I got to read good ones. They got to be reliable. They got to have footnotes. And they've got to be balanced. They can't be hagiographical accolades with no serious criticism. So he pointed me to Peter Brown, said that's a classic now. And I stumbled on this Agostino Trappi that has all these neat anecdotes in it. And then I knew I had to read the Confessions. And then I knew I had no time to read the City of God. And so the rest of my reading was all topically oriented. I just searched for particulars because I knew my topic. I gave the topic after reading the Confessions. That's all. I read the Confessions real early. I said, I got to pick a topic because they're all constantly on me for a title, you know. And so I gave him the title, and then that shaped the rest of my reading. I was tracking down whether he said these sorts of things elsewhere. So here's reality. Augustine's impossible to comprehend. Calvin's impossible. Luther's impossible. Edwards is impossible for any of you to get a handle on. They're Alps, and you walk in the Alps. You don't put the Alps in you. You put yourself in the Alps. So relax and enjoy it. Just find one. Plan next fall or this summer. You're going to do a series of biographies for your church, Sunday evening or Wednesday. Pick a few. Pick one solid biography and say, that's all I'm going to read. And believe me, you can get an hour's worth for anybody out of a biography. And The danger is that you want to say too much. So I came down the stairs the other day from Noel and passed my wife on the steps, and I said, I'm slaughtering Augustine. Meaning I have 70 single space pages of notes, and I'm hacking away at them mercilessly. I got to stop talking so much. I answered too long. We got other things.
This is addressed to Dr. Wells, but having a couple pastors up there respond would be helpful as well. I appreciate all that you've helped me in understanding modernism and its effect on all of us, and its rampant consumerism and its self-seeking, especially for psychological or therapeutic benefits. The thing that I wrestle with as a pastor of a small church is always this tension between pandering to what is true of our age and wrestling with compromising, obscuring the gospel, missing what the true mission of the church is, and on the other hand, not wanting to be stilted or frozen or ineffective or small because of choices that I make. It seems to me that success is definitely at the level of pandering to modernism. I'm not saying that everyone that's successful is pandering, but I'm wondering if you can help us pastors wrestle with the issue of how do you recognize when we're pandering, when we should stop and say no, or dealing with that tension of, you know, serving, self-seeking, especially for the psychological benefits.
Well, I wish I was more puzzled by the problem. Your question, when do you know whether or not you're pandering? I take it you're really asking how much and to what extent can you capitalize upon the practices, habits, assumptions, worldviews of the people in the pew. How much can you take those over in order to make the gospel message more successful? I'd say it's not a problem. You mustn't do it. Your objective, and here is where you need skill. Your objective is to bring people in the pews into the worldview of the Bible. And that is very simple to say. It's harder to do, because of some of the things that you have in mind, that there'll be people sitting in the pews expecting you to say certain things. They've got an agenda on their mind, and they're wondering why on earth you aren't addressing it. When are you going to get around to addressing anxiety? This is what's most important to me, etc. But this is a slow process. People need to be translated from the kingdom of darkness in their heads into the kingdom of God's dear Son through Scripture. It's through truth. It's in one sense we are redeemed in Christ, and yet we're not fully redeemed until we are in heaven. And that's what you're involved in. It's a process of redeeming the way people look at themselves and their world, and bringing them skillfully, maybe even charmingly, bringing them into the world of Scripture. So it's easy to describe. I know it's harder to do. It's harder to do because those people in the pews have their own agendas, and they want you to do certain things. So over a process of time, what you're going to be working at is changing those internal agendas so that they begin to want something different. Alistair, you know about these things.
Can I talk?
Yes, sure you do.
Actually, the question that you just asked was the question that I asked you last evening at supper time.
You didn't get a better answer last night either.
Actually, I didn't get an answer last night. No, so. That was because I talked too long and didn't give you a chance to answer, which is a problem. I don't know that I have anything to add except to say that I wrestle with that on a consistent basis myself. And I have been greatly helped in the last wee while by, first of all, being in the company of Don Carson for a week in London and having the chance to ride in taxis with him and talk about this whole idea of preaching to the postmodern mind and his big thing about the need for the meta-narrative and establishing the big picture, which is what David is saying, that we've got to bring people into a worldview to tell them that there's the good, the bad, the new, and the perfect. And that the whole world can be understood under those in that framework. It seems to me that what I was referring to briefly yesterday, this idea of fusing the two worlds of the cultural horizon and theological principles is the great skill package, which I think Paul does masterfully in Acts 17. I mean, he doesn't walk in and say, Jesus Christ is resurrected from the dead, and I think you ought to think about that for 5 minutes. He walks in and he says, I've been walking around here for a day and a half. You guys are really into religion, aren't you? People going, yeah, well, I suppose so, yeah. I mean, I never saw so many idols in my life. Yeah, some really bizarre ones, aren't there? Yeah, there are. I say, I'll tell you the one I like best. That one you've got to the unknown God. Said, yeah, we put that up there, you know, just in case we missed him. And Paul says, you did miss him. In fact, if you've got a minute, I'd like to tell you about it. Now, that, I think, is where you know, if you do that, provided you've got somewhere to go theologically next, it's legitimate. If you do that and then go to U.S. Airways magazine with 7 principles on how to relieve stress, then you ought to jump out of a plane at 32,000 feet without a parachute. So for me, again, this whole idea of I know exactly that I'm starting from the scriptures. But to say that I start from the scriptures does not necessarily mean that I say in the book of Malachi and in chapter 1, verse 9. I mean, I may start and say Sting's song is such and such and such and such, depending on who I'm talking to. And I find that the circles I move in, the guys are afraid to do that because they think it's a capitulation. But it's not at all. And so we need a wee bit of freedom in relationship to that, I think. Provided at our core we know that we're beginning with God and his glory rather than with man and his need. And I don't mind talking about, you know, Camus' God-shaped hole or whoever came up with that one in the first place. I don't think it was John. But I mean, I'm a little bit wary of starting with I know you all have holes in your lives, and I've got something to plug your hole for you. Because that can so easily become, you know, it's the 60s thing. You know, Jesus Christ, you know, I got the right one, baby. And Jesus Christ, I have Jesus Christ for you. He can add to the sum of your total happiness. Well, big deal. So can transcendental meditation. So I think that what we have to do is not simply scratch people where they itch, but it's we've got to bring the word of God to bear upon their lives that makes them itchy. And then once they get itchy and start to scratch, then we can tell them why they're scratching.
Yes, this question is for George Verwer. Just wanted to thank you, first of all, for Operation World book. Really enjoyed and appreciated that. And by the way, I have 2 copies before I came here. But really wanted your opinion, as of today, how you see the different evangelical mission organizations and missionaries working together to spread a passion for the supremacy of God around the world. Are we working together, the different organizations, and how are we doing in comparison with the cults that are out there spreading their false gospel?
Well, there's over 26,000 denominations now in the world, and that's, you know, throughout the whole globe. And it's easy to some people say there's greater unity. I don't actually see that myself. I think because of various kinds of extremism, false doctrine, that the church in many ways, again, whether we're talking about the whole church or just those true believers, that's another complexity in talking about these things. But I personally, on a global scale, see an increase of disunity, not unity. But there are tremendous pockets of unity. My greatest burden is that there might be unity just in that one local fellowship so that they can at least function in their own city. There's big pressure on us in missions to have partnership, and we pioneered one of those in among Afghans. Partnership on the mission field means people from different missions come and work together as one team, and they don't emphasize their mission society, which is good. But we're finding it hard to find the men or women who can lead those kind of partnerships. We have another one in Tajikistan, the flag country. But we've had some tension there because people come from different missions. And just like someone referred to, David, the people in the pew, with their different agendas, you know, different missionaries have different agendas. So working together in partnership, though, we're still doing that. And there's an increase of that. I'm talking about evangelical people, biblical people from evangelical societies or fellowships. But we must not presume that it's easy. You need a higher level of leadership with greater communication skills. Now, what there is, I think, I call this a grace awakening in missions. In general, missionaries have a pretty good attitude one toward another, and are praying together and fellowshipping together, often more than I find in home cities. It just blows my mind to find cities or towns in America where the ministers who claim to love Jesus and believe his Bible, they're not praying together, they don't get together, you know, even once in a blue moon. So there is that increased unity among missionaries and workers. Out of that is coming some synergy. Southern Baptists have made a tremendous confession about their past. We will do it on our own mentality. And so Southern Baptists are pace setters right now in some fields on working more together. And I would just add to that, I think the key in this is esteeming others. Philippians chapter 2, esteeming others better than yourself. But in certain situations, I believe if there's a good team, they're from the same mission, they ought to get on with it. Get the churches planted. Get the people reached. Go for it. Not get too bogged down in trying to have some kind of unity that in the end they're not going to get it anyway. But there'd be people that wouldn't be too happy about that statement. Not on this panel.
My question is for John Piper mostly. I wonder, John, if you'd like to offer any cautions about Augustine. Of course, the Alps are beautiful and breathtaking, but not without their dangers. And I remember reading extensively in a couple of the Library of Christian Classics volumes, and I learned to sort of flip ahead very quickly when he began allegorizing the Old Testament, or when he talked about marriage and sex. And in that second instance, he seemed to be advocating the asceticism that Paul warns against in 1 Timothy 4.
The one that I would that I stumbled over most is his relentless appeal to baptismal regeneration, which I cannot understand. I just don't understand in the context of the confessions, even let alone what he writes at the end of his life in *To Simplician*, and yet talks endlessly about being reborn through the waters of baptism. So that happened 6 months after the garden experience. He was baptized on Easter of 387. So I think that, along with, I don't know what his own view of the Lord's Supper was. That didn't fall within my reading. But I would guess that's why Warfield said that the Reformation was the triumph of Augustine's vision of grace over his vision of the church. Church meaning all kind, a cluster of ideas that flowed into the Roman Catholic tradition. So I would caution you to read him very carefully and make those distinctions. Read that essay in Warfield's book called Calvin and Augustine is the name of the book. I don't know what he said about sex in marriage, but as I read the confessions and tried to answer that question yesterday, it seemed to me that he was walking on the precipice of disobedience to that verse in 2 Timothy where the person admonishes not to marry or eat certain foods, and Paul rebukes that person pretty severely and says that we are to receive these things as created if we receive them with the word and thanksgiving. So, a warning well taken.
John, can I just piggyback on that? In defense of Augustine, although I get terribly uneasy with this talk about baptismal regeneration, but his argument was that God's electing decree is worked out through the means of the baptismal regeneration. So that's how he was actually able to put together a view of the church which he had with a kind of soteriology which was later on to surface in all of its sort of fire in Luther and the Reformers. But I agree with you. It's a very strange thing. And those, on the other hand, today who believe in baptismal regeneration rarely ever link it up with the electing decree of God. I mean, that would be anathema to them.
Let me. Do you know whether he thought he was born again in the garden? In other words, is regeneration so tied to the ex opere operato of the water that he would not have looked back upon that critical moment as being born again?
No, I think he really is a forerunner of evangelical Lutherans who hold to both baptismal regeneration and who also believe that regeneration takes place outside of the waters. And I scratch my head at them. I just don't understand it. On the matter of sex and marriage, would you maybe think that this would be a place where perhaps his Platonism intruded maybe a little bit unhelpfully? The great thing about that and the reason that he was able to marry it to his Christian faith, I think very successfully, and over time I think it was subjugated to his faith. The reason for it is that in Platonism you get this overwhelming concern for what is unseen and invisible, which is what we have in Christian faith too. But the problem is with Platonism, it is often carried out at the expense of the reality and the significance of what's created. And I think that's the point at which, when he came to talk about sex, he emphasized the good thing of desiring God, but the path or the means that he got there maybe wasn't so good in this particular instance.
Now, this is for Pastor John Piper as well as the others. Much of what has been said at the conference reflects on this. But in light of the context that we live in a culture that promotes the joy of getting stuff and having things, how do you find joy in our God in possessions and money, particularly when it comes to retirement and savings and those sorts of things?
First, by delighting in him so much that you don't have much savings or much retirement, and thus make giving an evidence of your superior allegiance to him. My God will supply all your needs in Christ Jesus. God is able to supply you with every blessing in abundance so that you may have enough of everything and may do every good work. Secondly, insofar as you have, you thank him for having, and he gets thanks, and you acknowledge that He gives to all men life and breath and everything, and you are utterly and totally dependent on Him for every heartbeat and every breath you take and every dollar you earn. As Deuteronomy says, it was God who gave you the power to get this wealth. Be careful. And thirdly, by spending it, either now or in retirement, on values that will reflect His character, which probably doesn't mean move to Phoenix, but rather join OM at age 75 and do something that probably only old gray-haired people among Muslims can do. You got an illustration about that?
70, did you say 75?
Yeah. You're all young people, aren't you? You got any 75-year-olds that are...
Well, certainly without these older people who are captains and chief engineers, our two ships would not have been able to continue these 28 years. But there are other situations as well. And there's a new movement that's having a conference soon called Finishers. The whole thrust of Finishers is people taking early retirement and getting involved in missions.
So don't get a yacht. Get a Logos-sized boat.
This is a question for George Verwer. I would also like to hear what John Piper, how he would address the question. The biggest tension, I think, for me, personally and biblically, that I've wrestled through is just the radical call to missions and the responsibilities of the family. And even this morning, as you were challenging us to send the chairman of our elder board overseas, my soul started to thrill because I thought he'd be a great missionary. And then I thought, he has 6 children, 9 and under. Would you want him to go to Tajikistan with Operation Mobilization? And how would you like to see pastors teach about that whole tension?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. And I think I was asking the question, you know, what would happen if suddenly the chairman of your elders board sensed the Holy Spirit was sending him. Later on in the message, you'll remember that I pointed out very clearly that there's already 30,000 people approximately that have already volunteered to go. How many of those would be the kind of mature people that I was referring to earlier? You know, only the Lord knows. But I'm convinced, of course, that much depends on whether that local church is ready to commend him and send him. And of course, if there's a lot of children and family, it often, humanly speaking, does become impossible because of the educational complexities, the financial mountains that have to be moved. And that's one of the toughest issues we are facing in missions in the United States. The high cost, especially of American missionaries, who are usually always at double the support level, even then people from European countries. So I don't have a quick, easy answer to that. I believe people should learn to live on a simpler lifestyle. I believe that older people, like even that man, could be used, but it takes a lot of time, training, and preparation. A lot depends on their skills. If that man is a doctor, that door may open a lot easier than if he's teaching water skiing at the University of Florida. So there's a lot of variety there.
Well, real practically, Greg Peterson is sitting right back there as the chairman of our missions board and has 7 kids. And I hope he goes to Kazakhstan for a couple of years, Greg.
I have a question for Dr. Wells. In your, I think it was your first lecture, you talked about the abundance of PhDs. And so I was wondering what type of evangelical scholars are needed today. I'm not talking about jobs. Is there a job there today? Will there be one tomorrow? But if you were looking and interested in evangelical scholarship, what areas of studies would most benefit the church?
I don't remember mentioning that in the lecture, but I did mention it in private afterwards. I'm just saying that because I'm wondering if I'm losing my mind. Did I say that in the lecture?
I did? All right, I am losing my mind. Well, I don't have to worry about that anymore. It's gone. Well, I think the answer is that the kind of scholars we want has to do with quality and outlook rather than particular field. With respect to field, I can tell you that New Testament is simply flooded and followed by the Old Testament. If we put an ad out for a New Testament person, we could get 200 applicants. And the sad thing is that many of these people have studied at fine universities and paid a lot of money and so forth. But I think the real issue is rather the quality of scholarship. You may know the so-called new class thesis. The argument is, amongst some sociologists, that we have emerging in America a new class. It's the knowledge class. It's all of those people who are involved in the production and dissemination of knowledge and who live off knowledge. I belong to the knowledge class because I make my living off knowledge. But what a lot of studies have shown and what you yourself have observed is that this knowledge class has a distinct tilt toward the left. If you have been on any college campuses, university campuses, you will see it. And with the tilt toward the left, not merely politically, but in all areas, you have rampant relativism and so forth. And in the academic guild, if you want to make forward progress, you have to find acceptance within that guild. Now, this is a very, very insidious and threatening pressure to scholars, young scholars coming up. Not a great many of those graduates from our seminaries who go off to university and get their PhDs, you would want to come back and teach in your churches. A great many get washed down the drain. And if they don't go down intellectually, they go down spiritually. So in answer to your question, what we need today, I believe, is men and women who know God and who have the courage to state that intellectually, even if it costs them in the guild. Nobody could have written the books I have written in a university and survived. It's just a fact.
I just have a general question that's addressed to all of you, and I'd appreciate just a really brief response to be able to hear from as many of you as possible on this question. And the question is, what is your greatest challenge, bottom line, as a minister of the gospel, as a husband, and as a father?
Prayerfulness to regard, to quote from the front of an OMF booklet, if my prayer is meager, it is because I regard it as supplemental and not fundamental. And the challenge of prayer, both privately and publicly, in pastoral ministry is a supreme challenge to me. And then the prayerfulness and along with that, then in terms of family, that we would live out the very purity that we're talking about with our wives, and that we would be the father to our children in all that that means. I mean, it doesn't need any exposition. All the things that you're supposed to do, that we would at least try and do. And so I always, when I travel, I ask that people would pray that I would remain true to Christ, true to His Word, true to my wife, and true to my kids, and true to my calling. And then that would be good.
be against?
Oh, I don't have any wisdom on this beyond what Alistair said. I think probably we all face the same kind of thing. The difficulty I face is that I have too many things that too many people want me to do, too many people who expect me to be involved in this and that, and all of these possibilities and opportunities are good, but you always have to come back and ask yourself what it is you're supposed to be doing. And the thing that I fear, I think, as much as anything else, is becoming launched on a kind of career of being known in this and that place, because that's the last thing in the world I want to do. What I want to do in the years that remain to me is simply to be a faithful witness to the truth of God to whoever wants to listen to me in this time, in this very difficult time. And that may seem like a simple thing, but it's actually very hard. And every day I find myself tempted in one way or another to deviate from that.
Well, I think we're all so different and experience things different ways, but my burden is that this reality of knowing God, which is I've experienced since my conversion, that it may grow greater and greater and impact every single aspect of my life, while at the same time maintaining that reality of 1 Corinthians 13. Because without that, we don't have much. So that's just my bottom line.
The prayer I go back to most often, perhaps, for my own self, is Ephesians 3, that I might have power to comprehend with all the saints what is the height and depth and length and breadth, and to know the love of Christ and be filled with all the fullness of God. That phrase, be filled with all the fullness of God, is the biggest challenge of my life.
This question is for Dr. Piper and anyone else who would like to respond. In chapter 6 of Confessions, St. Augustine writes about the power of theater in moving people. And he writes exclusively about it in very negative ways. And I was wondering what your attitudes were toward his thoughts on the theater. He implies that to be moved emotionally by a melodrama or a tragedy is folly or a waste of time. And I wondered what your personal thoughts were on the matter, as well as your thoughts on his.
I don't remember it very well, and he's probably talking simply about pagan theater and the kinds of emotions that can elicit. And for him, anything now, as a believer, that wasn't done for God's sake is going to be worthless. It could be anything. So that would be, it'd sweep secular theater away. So are you aiming towards theater in the church, or theater in general, or?
Yeah, in general.
Well, my life exists to spread a passion for the supremacy of God in all things, including the theater, and therefore my critique is radical of contemporary cinema. It's godless. 99 and 44, 100%. All television is godless. And therefore, Christians should handle it the way they do everything else that's godless. You have to go out of the world to escape godlessness, so it may mean, it doesn't mean you might not see any of it, but you bring to bear on it a radical critique. Walt Disney, as bad as anything else. Just everything is godless. He is absent. He is shriekingly absent. Or he's maligned. Those are the two possibilities. And therefore, Christians should be weeping and enraged and bringing that critique to bear. The other side, I think I'll just pass on as to the role of drama in the church. I would just say in passing that I think it is not in the category of preaching. It's not in the category of parables because it's make-believe. You're posturing to be something that you're really not. There's a place for that. I doubt that it's in the place of a sermon. This may be a place to say something radical. Let's get really radical and fundamentalistic here. I don't think you should go see movies that have any nudity in them, period. That means Scotland, 3-hour movie, Braveheart. That includes Braveheart. And yes, now most recently, the Titanic. I got an email from a 12-year-old girl in this church last night saying she can't believe that her friends are going to see the Titanic. I haven't seen it. Evidently, there's some nudity in it. One scene in Braveheart. Now, here's the reason. If you have a daughter, like I've got a 2-year-old daughter, I'm going to say this to my people soon on Sunday. I'm going to say, every one of you parents who decides to go to see a movie that has one 30-second bare breast must give an account to your daughter why she cannot pose for that. And you can't do it.
Please turn the tape over now for the remainder of the message.
Joel Belt said this in an editorial in World Magazine. That daughter, I'm going to say to the little girls in the first service and the little boys, I'm going to say, ask your parents if you have a school play and they ask you to take off your clothes for just a minute for the school play. Nobody will touch you, but everybody will just look at you because it's part of the play. Would they let you do that? Ask them. And if they say no, then ask them why they go to a movie that necessitates somebody's daughter taking off her clothes with men standing all around photographing her. Don't do it.
I think this is primarily for John, but I'd appreciate anyone's response there. The supremacy of God in contemporary worship. I'd like your thoughts on that in the music that's coming forth, the way it's being expressed in many of our churches. We all deal with that. So much of it seems to be more oriented towards the pleasure of the people than the pleasure of God. Could you just speak to that and perhaps give us some guidelines and, if you would, be radical again? Yes, you, John.
I'm probably not going to be radical the way you want me to be. I'm not sure. Start with the content and make it absolutely the non-negotiable. That is, the lyrics of the music should be biblical, and probably you'll want to push towards substance. Now, I do believe with all my heart that one phrase sung several times can be powerful and precious in the right place at the right moment to respond to some more substance elsewhere. If you start with the non-substance and you just assume that the music is going to create the necessary emotions that will bring some kind of content, it can happen. I mean, the emotions can come, but that won't be it. So content is king, I believe, here in these things. And then I think the way you combine the historic and the contemporary will be an artistic work, a spiritual / artistic work that very few people have. And you need to smell it, how it works and how it can flow in and out. You need to take the temperature of your own congregation about the ethos of their own musical understanding. And where are they? What's their culture? I mean, the music that comes out of China and Japan is absolutely unusable here. Ching, 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 or whatever. It just means nothing to us. And so culture is a crucial element in where the people are and what they can. And then think in terms of how to help them move across the spectrum from folk to fine. The best thing I could do, I think, instead of keeping talking here, is direct you to the paper that we have available in some filing cabinet somewhere on my reflections on folk and fine. The values of folk and the values of fine. Folk life is ordinary life. Fine life is intellectual life. They both are absolutely precious and crucial. The dangers are opposite and great in both of them. The danger of fine tends to be elitism and intellectualism and snobbery, and the danger of folk tends to be the same at a different kind of level. And so you've got to take both, though. God is the God of the Mount of Transfiguration, and he's the God of the Mount of Olives. On the Mount of Transfiguration, on their faces, didn't know what to say. He was absolutely, transcendently, indescribably glorious. There's music and lyrics that correspond to that. Then, on the Mount of Olives, putting his feet up, leaning on his elbow, saying to Peter, how did it go today? He said, terrible. He said, I love you anyway, and put his arm around him, and there's this intimate family thing. That's a different kind of music. That's not a mighty fortress. That's not God of Abram praise. That's loving you, Jesus, loving you. There is no greater thing. That's Mount of Olives music. And then there's music all over the place in between. God is that way. We are that way. We need to cross those spectrums. And it takes artists, it takes deep souls to know how not to mess up a service with trying to do everything at once. And that's the best I can do in.
Question for George Verwer. Where do I get one of those great jackets? More seriously, you don't have to answer that question.
We handle these jackets, all the five different sizes. They're $30.
I'll pretend I didn't hear that. My question is, and all that I've read or heard when you go to missions conferences and read mission material, there seems to be often a gaping hole in understanding the church's role and opportunity to minister to the international students here in the United States. That is to say that of the 400,000 international students today in the U.S., I find so little talk when it comes to missions for churches, pastors, missionaries, about the responsibility and need to do so. What are your thoughts, I guess, to speak to us as pastors about our responsibilities, our privileges, and getting our people to think globally, perhaps by just walking next door and making friends with those who are international students? Just comment, if you would, on that kind of ministry and how it may help us to do missions in the big picture.
It's one of the things I actually spoke on last night. As I was speaking about Afghanistan, I brought the attention to the people that we have many, many Afghan people living in Washington, D.C. and in many other cities. And in fact, we have most of the peoples of the 1040 window living in our own nation. And if we don't respond to that, then that is an unbelievable tragedy. And it's something I've been speaking on for 40 years. One of our main works in London, England, we have about 300 people full-time in the British Isles now, many different ministries, as that Europe is OM's heartland. But one of our teams in London works exclusively among Muslims. Now, that's different than the student thing. There are groups working among students. There's a whole organization committed to that. Several other smaller organizations. I don't know if they came out from the bigger one. but it's minute compared to the challenge. Some of those organizations have the strategy of trying to get the church into this. And there have been some real encouragements with people, God's people, really befriending international students, seeing conversions. But it's a small percentage of people who are into this and a small percentage of churches. So I believe that is a very important part of the missionary challenge to our nation at this time. The people in our midst, and of course, we're talking about a wide range of peoples, from our Mexican friends, tremendous prejudice against Mexicans in certain places. They're all over the country. Our Native American friends, we know the complexity of that. But to me, all of these things are part of the challenge. Of course, we have to make sure we just don't get overwhelmed by it all, intimidated by it all, and then we don't do anything. And I think with our congregations, we need to be careful that we don't just, you know, clobber them with so many challenges that they can't function. They just turn against themselves and get discouraged. We need to be lifting them up, caring, and some of these people in our churches, we really do have to go quite slow, one step at a time, but we must at least keep going.
These questions are for Dr. Piper and Pastor Begg. Dr. Piper, you said specifically in other things I've heard you say, and that life is fundamentally war, and that pastoral ministry, as we all know, would be no exception. And I was just curious that, given the fact that we're, as pastors, faced with a multitude of opportunities, just like other folks are, but uniquely in pastoral ministry, a multitude of opportunities to put the weight of our hope in something other than everything that God promises to be for us in Jesus, what kinds of particular things have you installed in your life and Pastor Begg's life and to guard and to defend against that? That'd be one question. And the other one was something that you raised yesterday about the area of communication. And you said that it was kind of a weak link in younger pastors preaching, not making the next step towards clarity and precision in communication. And what kinds of things would you suggest doing to strengthen that?
I'm not sure I got that last part and what I... making the next step.
Well, you were mentioning yesterday, you were talking about in preaching and communication, uh-huh. The necessity of, you were talking about writing particularly and how important it is to work towards clarity and communication and precision.
That was you.
Was it you? Sorry.
You talked about writing. One of you did.
You did. Yes.
So I'll defer that one and just take the first one.
I remember Begg's talk better than he does.
And we remember yours better than you do. Yeah. Which is good, because there's 500 of us. Number one, we don't have a television. Number two, I don't take any royalties from my books. In other words, I'm answering the question, what safeguards do you build in? I'm scared of being wealthy, very scared. Wealthy people have an awful hard time getting into the kingdom. And I'm scared of my own temptation. And therefore, you know, if I were to watch the Super Bowl, I know that what I'd remember is Budweiser commercials. I know a friend who tapes the whole Super Bowl and erases the ball game so he can watch the commercials. They're better. They're genius. They're hilarious. And they're all laced with sexual innuendo. Or the worst thing about television is not sex. The worst thing about television is banality. Most of my people, I think, live lives feeling like life is banal. Very few people have capacities for deep joy or high rage or indignation. Except when they get, you know, stepped on or something. But for great moral vision, television is a killer of life. So those are two steps. And then you build in radical disciplines of Bible reading. I'm a real stickler for believing that if you want fruit to grow in your garden, you put the plow in and you push it, rain or shine. You don't wait until some emotion comes. You know emotion will or will not come if you're looking at the book. So there are unflinching disciplines in my life. Then you get enough sleep. And then you get exercise. You build non-negotiables into your life. And those are just a few. Go ahead, Alistair.
Okay. Well, I do have a television. And I do take royalties from my books. However, since I don't sell any books, it doesn't really pose a threat to me.
It will, brother. It will.
Well, if I sold as many as John, then I can understand his concern. Although I would say that, interestingly, and along the same line, being on the radio now, as we are across the nation, there is no remuneration generated to me through anything that has to do with the radio. No royalties from tapes or from the sale of books or even my own books or anything like that, for the very same reasons. I mean, exact same reasons. Because, it's a fearful thing to me, and two, I think it diminishes credibility in being able to come and go amongst people. But everyone must work out their own salvation with fear and trembling in relationship to these things. I love watching sports, and TV, I share the banality and everything, particularly with American television. You've got it down to a fine art here. There are some things on public television that actually qualify as drama, that qualify as art, that I think you can view with your grandmother or with your daughters. And I choose to walk the path of discrimination, which leaves you open to the risk of falling over the cliff on one side or the other. I do that. In terms of clarity, I think what I was talking about was the disengagement between, or closing the gap between thinking that because I've thought it, I can say it. And I was suggesting that it is, for me at least, in the process of writing it and reviewing it, that I understand whether I have really said it or not, or whether if what I've just written on the page I was to read would make any sense at all. Or if the sentences are all Pauline in terms of their length, or if I began in the past tense, finished in the future tense, and was in the subjunctive here and all over the place. I'm talking about that kind of precision in relationship to the use of language. Everyone acknowledged the tremendous ability of Churchill in the House of Commons. Only those who have read him carefully recognize that he stayed up half the night and sometimes all of the night driving his secretary to distraction as he reworked phrases again and again and again. I'm not suggesting that we emulate that example, but that is what I was making reference to. And that's why when you hear a number of people speak, they're always correcting themselves. They're always saying, they're wasting valuable time saying, no, what I mean by that is, no, I didn't mean that. What I mean is, I'm suggesting, you know, and you're going, well, work it out and then say it, you know, but don't include me in the process. And so, because life is short.
My question is for George. I have been told that God is doing great things outside the United States, but I've also been told that often that's much more charismatic, Pentecostal, maybe more of the miraculous is happening. Is that true? If so, why? Could you just speak to that?
I already did try to at least touch on that, and I believe it is not true that God is doing more outside of the United States. God is, of course, working all over the world. Some countries are completely left out. But there are other countries like, say, Korea, Brazil, Argentina, a number of African countries where recently the church growth has been quite spectacular, whereas in the United States our bigger church growth has been more in the past. It's leveled off a bit now. But the sheer size of the already existing church in the States is so huge that even if things are not so good right at the moment, there's this massive reservoir of committed people of all different degrees. And I guess to make it short, I don't know anywhere in the world where it's that much better. And I think the greater difference is between one church and another church rather than between Argentina and England or Britain and or Canada and, say, Korea. So I think some people, especially in their desire to get us more committed here, we have a lot of prophets of doom, a lot of conspiracy people in America, and in order to get us to feel miserable, which they are hoping will then lead us to be more dedicated, or at least put money in the offering, they tell these horrible stories about in America and how terrible we all are in comparison to revival in Argentina or church growth in Korea. It's just not that simple. Now, internationally, it is true that the bigger church growth tends to be in what some people call a charismatic side. That greatly varies from country to country. In Brazil, that would be generally true, but there'd be other non-charismatic churches in Brazil that also would be phenomenal. And in Korea, it would be less true. In Korea, a lot of the big church growth has been among more somewhat staid Presbyterians. Sometimes when they pray, they all pray at once. And so, non-discerning Americans, which is most of us, think, oh, these must all be, Pentecostals. But they're not. They're Presbyterians who have that style of praying. I don't know if that's of any help.
Thank you.
This is a question for all of you, and Tom, you can answer this if you'd like as well. I'm interested in hearing what are the most, if you can narrow it down, one or two of the most significant books that have impacted your hearts and lives. If you were stranded on a desert island with a Bible and one or two other books, what would it be? And before you answer, George, I know you take your inflatable globe so you could play on the beach. What would those be?
I would take with me the Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones's book, Spiritual Depression, Its Cause and Cure. Unfortunately, the title sort of miscommunicates, but that particular book, which I've spent quite a lot of time in, I would classify as one of the great, overall great sort of spiritual encyclopedias for people that are serious about following Christ and His Word.
Well, I think actually there are two different questions there. To be on a desert island, where you want spiritual sustenance is one thing. Those turning points in your life where particular books have been very significant, I think that's a different question. And for what it's worth, I think the two books that have been probably most important to me because of the particular junctions I was at that time is first, Edwards' discussion of the freedom of the will. If you let him take you past about page 15, you'll lose the argument with him. If you're with him up to page 15, then he's got you. And he got me. The other book, strangely enough, is Heinrich Heppe's Reformed Dogmatics, which Karl Barth says reads like a table of logarithms. But it's actually a magnificent volume in which Heppe peruses the Reformed dogmaticians, of the 17th and 18th century and collects together their statements under all of the loci, like the omniscience of God, for example, then you have all of the statements. And it really is an awesome thing to read it, because it is a first-class piece of evidence that the human race is not developing. If you compare Heinrich Heppe, if you compare the sort of depth and profundity and clarity that at one point we had in theological matters with what passes today and what pours off our presses and even among some of our better authors, I think you'll agree we've taken about 7 steps backwards.
Well, I think that I would definitely take No Place for Truth and probably Future Grace.
He's very tactful, this guy.
May the Lord forgive me for telling lies. If I was on a desert island, one of the books would be a hymn book, without question. When I have ministerial, when I have the blues, and I have never known anything approaching clinical depression, or if I did, no one told me. But when I have the blues, I go to my hymn books. I take them in the car, and I sing out by myself before the throne of God above. I have a strong and perfect plea, a great high priest whose name is Love, whoever lives and pleads for me. And when Satan tempts me to despair and tells me of the guilt within, upward I look and see him there who made an end to all my sin, and so on. I would definitely have a hymn book, and I think probably, and I wouldn't always have said this, but I think I would have Calvin's Institutes as the other book with me. In terms of books that have impacted me, oh goodness, there are just so many of them, but I have to say that when I read both volumes of Lloyd-Jones, the biography, it stirred me, moved me, challenged me, enthralled me, just made me jump up and down. And when I read, as Murray suggests that you should, his letters to his wife, which are an appendix at the back of volume 2, and Murray says, read them first before you read the second volume, which I did. And especially when you have that picture of Lloyd-Jones on the front, so austere. I mean, I've introduced my pastoral team to Lloyd-Jones, and they're like, who is this man? I mean, does he ever smile, for goodness sake? And so when I got to the back of the book, and I can tell you've all been there by the glaze that's on your eyes, but when I got to the back of the book, and he writes, my dear Bethan, you know, I feel as though I have been gone from you already for a lifetime. Oh, I said, hey, I got to read a little bit more about this. And suddenly it opened another vista into Lloyd-Jones's life. And I just, that book I love. And there are so many others. I think just because we're here as pastors, I think the same thing happened to me early on in the 70s in reading Richard Baxter's The Reformed Pastor. And particularly when he talks to those men and he says that you would starve to death with the bread of life upon your hands. And that chilling possibility of professionalism having squeezed out a heart for God. But if you ask me again in 5 minutes, there would be different books, I'm sure.
I'll mention 3, not on the desert island side, but on the Turning Point side. The first would be The Unity of the Bible by Daniel Fuller. And the second would be Validity in Interpretation by E.D. Hirsch. And the third would be The End for Which God Created the World by Jonathan Edwards. The latter is a book I owe so much that when I take a leave here in 3 weeks, I intend to write an introduction for it, which will be as long as the book itself, and publish it with Crossway. You know, it'll just be The End for Which God Created the World by Jonathan Edwards and John Piper. And it's a way of making it available cheap, because it's not available cheap. You have to buy the whole second volume, I mean two volumes of Edwards, or you have to buy, you know, the $75 single volume of Yale, and that's not a good deal for anybody, unless you're going to get them anyway. So the debt I owe Edwards is untold, and that book is as close to the center as you can get, I think. Validity in Interpretation, most important book on hermeneutics in my life. Very simple thesis. The meaning of a text is the intention of the author. And the only possible way of ascribing validity to any interpretation is to make that your goal, to find that intention.
Okay, we have about 5 minutes left, so but I'd like to get all these questions. So I think we're over here. Go ahead.
This question is for Dr. Wells, and forgive me if I read it. I had to work out my thoughts to write it down. It's really a statement and then a question. I hear and agree with your judgment of our culture's gospels of psychotherapy and advertisement, and it made me think of Paul in his day, and I asked what were the prevailing soteriologies that he confronted, and I thought of the sophists and their love for wisdom, the God system, the Epicurean pleasure of the body, the mystery religions, and I asked how Paul presented the gospel to them, and it seemed that in a cursory fashion, at least, he affirmed a sort of a common grace virtue present in these, like we see in Acts 17, and then moved to the centrality of Christ in his life, death, and resurrection. My question is, are there sort of common grace virtues existent within the gospels of psychotherapy and advertisement that we can affirm in order to prepare the hearers for the stark intrusion of the historical gospel?
Well, I'm not sure quite about your premise about the presence of common grace in Athens. Common grace doesn't. Common grace is a reformed construct, and what it is really trying to encompass might be distributed partly under the doctrine of creation and partly under the doctrine of providence. Because what it is saying is that the God who created everything has preserved everything and therefore has not yielded the creation to its rebel inhabitants, but that he's not going to let us destroy entirely what he's made. So he puts boundaries, but they are invisible boundaries. Paul in Acts states, for example, in chapter 14, that God established boundaries around the nations. Now, we don't know where those boundaries are. We don't know where God has placed the boundary on America. Today, it looks as though there is no boundary. It looks as though America is supreme forever. But we know in 1989, at least, that the Marxists stubbed their toes on that boundary. That was the end. That was finish. Marxist regimes were over. But you and I don't know where those boundaries are. And the very nature of common grace is that if it's there, you can't interpret it. You can't get a handle on it. It's God's invisible working in the midst of fallen life. So to go back to your question, of course it is true that when Paul brought the gospel to that ancient world, there were all kinds of competitors, alternatives, ways of looking at life. And as Alistair mentioned, he showed imagination and thoughtful skill in knowing how to get those people from where they were to where he is with the gospel. However, I think there is a difference that we need to note. And the difference is that the things that I talked about, which are born by this culture, are giving to those ideas a collective expression which really wasn't true of the intellectual opponents that Paul faced. It is true there were little parties of sophists and so forth. But what we're thinking about with television and with our commercialized atmosphere is a statement which simply fills the air so that it becomes part of the very air that we breathe every single day. Now that, it seems to me, gives it
an intensity which a simple intellectual argument doesn't have. But more than that, when an intellectual argument is advanced, you know exactly what it is. Somebody is advocating these ideas. The problem with the atmosphere that we're in now is that much of it operates sub rosa. It's sort of, there's a subterfuge to it. There's a sort of concealed nature in the way that it works. And that, I think, is the great danger. So in terms of understanding the gospel, it does seem to me that we need, at some point, to illumine quite clearly what it is that people are thinking about themselves and their world and their self before the gospel can be believed.
These two brothers were standing before me, so let's take theirs first.
Okay. This is a question for Dr. Wells that occurred to me in the course of your second lecture yesterday. You gave us this very helpful insight from Lord Moulton, the three things that we should preserve, the law, the freedom, and then that middle ground that you say is shrinking away in American culture, the morality beyond legality. As I was thinking about that, the first passage that came to my mind as Paul's response to that shrinking away of the middle ground was 1 Corinthians 9, where your answer to the question what how we get to that morality beyond legality was only by the holiness of God. Paul in that chapter says to the Corinthians who are watching that middle ground shrink away, here's a better way of looking at strength. Going without your rights is stronger than hanging on to your rights, isn't it? It's a fairly straightforward kind of a question, and he appeals to their opportunity to boast and to their reward. So this potentially could be a question about the word only in your solution, that only the holiness of God solves this, because the word holiness doesn't occur in the chapter. But I think you're going to want to incorporate Paul's answer into your answer. How does Paul's appeal to my opportunity to boast and to my reward fit within your description of the holiness of God?
Well, I think it's a small part of it. What I was suggesting was that the cultivation of character, of moral character, is what is important. Now, we might want to make a distinction between character among those who know God and character or the practice of virtues in a society. Now, the latter becomes a much trickier matter because you're getting into civil religion and so forth. But I would say if you're talking about character, it surely includes what you have just mentioned. If you're talking about Christian godly character, that includes the ability and the desire to yield rights when it's important to do so. The larger question, though, in society, that is a much more obscure matter as to how in a society you actually nurture virtues. Now, some people may say, well, it doesn't matter if you do or don't. But it surely does matter, because it is surely better if less people are murdered, if there is less promiscuity, if there's less thievery, if there's more truth-telling. It surely does matter in a culture. And in our prayers, I believe we should be concerned with that. But how to bring about in the absence of regeneration, I think, it's an obscure question.
Thanks.
With apologies to those who are still standing, I think out of respect to those who have made our meal, we need to break and encourage those of you just maybe to come up and ask your last questions privately up here. But I'm going to ask if Pastor John would kind of close our conference in prayer and to give thanks.
And I want to express gratitude once more publicly to Alistair Begg and David Wells and George Verwer for joining us this year in the conference, and I know you'd like to express that too. So Father, as we leave one another now for another year, some of us, we want to thank you for meeting us, instructing us. Some of us sort of build our year around these precious times of reflection and worship and prayer and discussion. And we thank you for the rhythm. And now thank you for the food. And I pray for safety on the road and in the air for everyone who leaves, and that our next destination will find us coming stronger, deeper, more loving, more wise, more pure than when we came. For the sake of our people, for the sake of our families, for the sake of the nations. And everybody said, Amen.
Thank you for listening to this message from Desiring God, the ministry of John Piper, pastor for preaching at Bethlehem Baptist Church in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Feel free to make copies of this message for others, but please do not charge for those copies or alter the content in any way without permission. We invite you to visit Desiring God online at www.desiringgod.org, where you'll find hundreds of sermons, articles, radio broadcasts, and more, all available to you at no charge. Our online bookstore carries all of Pastor John's books, audio, and video resources, and you can also stay up to date on what's new at Desiring God. Again, our website is www.desiringgod.org, or call us toll-free at 1-888-346-4700. Our mailing address is Desiring God, 2601 East Franklin Avenue, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55406. Desiring God exists to help you make God your treasure, because God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in Him.